Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this week on The Weekly, Cyberpunk Red miniatures game, the best-selling other RPGs of 2020.
Okay.
And because you look so happy about it, I thought we would talk a little bit about the baggage of Cyberpunk.
Okay. I thought I might actually be up for as opposed to the miniatures game, but okay.
Right. Right. So it was just announced that because Cyberpunk Red, the core book is out now.
Yep.
So the box set, the starter set was out, and now the core book is out. But when the starter set, the box, which I'm forgetting the name of, when that was announced, they also announced a line of miniatures to kind of go along with it. And I think, maybe aligned with their pre-gens in that box.
I can see that, characters. Yeah.
And so, yeah, the Jumpstart Kit, that's what it
that's
was.
What it is, yeah.
Yeah. So when that was released, a line of miniatures were produced by Monster Fight Club. And they haven't done, there wasn't a lot else that I saw that they had done on the site that was noticeable.
Okay, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, and the miniatures are okay. They're a little, because they're based on illustrations that are kind of a little chunky and a little cartoony, they're not like kind of human scale. They're a little like big-handed, big feet kind of.
Okay.
But it works okay because a lot of people are in, you know, body armor and stuff. So it's not too bad. So it looks decent. They're a little bit on the Unreal side, but they are now going to produce a game. So the game is Cyberpunk Red Combat Zone.
Okay.
And in the game, combat zones are the kind of disputed, like the lawless disputed zones where anything goes, where the kind of gangs vie for control. So yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to work. I guess that's what the factions are going to be, because there's very distinct gangs in the cyberpunk world, and they're going to it's also probably going to follow the timeline. So Cyberpunk Red is not in the same era, the same decade of the recent released video game. So 2077 is kind of a little bit far future. So I think it's 2030.
I was thinking, let me get this wrong. I think the last tabletop RPG, Cyberpunk, put out by our Telsorian Games was Cyberpunk 2020.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, and then, so Red steps it up, I think, another decade. There's like an incident that, I think it's like the bombing of Arasaka or something that is like the defining point of that era.
Okay.
And similar to what they did with The Witcher, CD Projekt Red just kind of jumped way ahead of the known source, so they were a little bit more free to kind of do what they wanted. Because that's what they did. The Witcher books are—they're kind of they happen ahead, timeline in the future of The Witcher books. So everything's already happened, and they kind of resurrect the character they died. But I think they'd like that because it gives them a little bit more freedom to tell stories and not constantly be checking with lore or editors at the
slight tangent here. I tried watching the Witcher series.
Oh, right.
I didn't really like it all that much. Might try and go back. But somebody, and I forget who, I'll put a link, made a one-page Witcher RPG.
Uh-huh.
One of these two stats games.
Oh, right.
Your stats are, and fuck.
That works.
Which I think is absolutely hilarious, and I would play the hell out of that game. And they have a little character creation thing where it's like, you have to name your horse after a fish. You have to like do this combination to like make your Witcher character name, and I just thought the stats and fuck were exceptional. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that show is really frustrating once you start to get your head around like what they're doing with time.
Right.
It's like, that's not fair. You can't do that. You can't create this tension with things that are happening decades apart, you know, kind of cutting between action and you're like, wait a minute. Yeah, that was a little frustrating, but I guess they're doing another season of that. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. So,
back to Cyberpunk 2030.
So some skirmish game. So yeah, I think, I really think that Infinity has that kind of era and that kind of combat really fleshed out well.
Okay.
I think the system for Infinity is going to be hard to beat. It's really, really fun tactical.
I know you tried getting me into that, and I handed the Pan-Ocean box back to you. Sorry about that, because I just can't do miniatures games. Would you consider, and maybe this will lead into the discussion further on, would you consider the Infinity miniatures game a cyberpunk miniatures game, or sort of like a far future kind of miniatures game?
Yeah, the only reason that it comes to mind right away is because there's a lot of hacking mechanics.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so there's people in power armor, but there's also people that can override your power armor. So there's two levels of play. So there's, you know, you're kind of playing on the net or playing in the Matrix and playing physically, and there's a lot of interaction between that, and you can kind of spec your team one way or another to be very strong with hacking and very strong with just actual physical combat.
Right.
And also because the kind of the way they broke up factions in Infinity feels very similar. There's like, you know, kind of an Asian, yeah, Japanese faction. Right.
Never in a million years happen. Yeah, but okay. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So they, it has a similar DNA, but I think it's enough in the far future, and it's like divided into worlds and stuff. It's not people fighting in a bleak city.
Yeah. It's more like, the sense I got was more kind of like corporate espionage a bit, or maybe kind of like countries embroiled in some kind of conflict.
Right. But,
no, I was wondering, because I'm forgetting the name of it now, Osprey Games, the company that makes Frostgrave, mm-hmm. also has a, what they call a cyberpunk miniatures skirmish game.
Oh.
Yeah. Haven't looked at it.
Yeah.
Just like I haven't looked at the rules for Infinity. And I was wondering how you would make a cyberpunk miniatures game. And I think hacking would have to be part of it.
Right. To have those like kind of simultaneous levels of conflict, I think would be that, and that's kind of a key to it. So I think they'll probably do that, but you know, if you're using, I'm not sure how satisfying that'll be. The combat rules have to be really good. The hacking rules have to be really good, or else one is going to, it has to be balanced. Yeah. And I don't know. Yeah, but in Infinity, when your big brawler in his heavy combat with his, you know, heavy machine gun is totally paralyzed by a guy sitting on the other side of a wall just clicking a keyboard, it's infuriating. So, that works well.
Infuriating fun or infuriating where you're actually going to flip the table?
It's good. Yeah, it's a good balance. It doesn't, you know, it's not just scale and size and, you know, there has a nice, there's nice subtlety to that system, and certain teams can overpower other teams that you wouldn't expect. Right. So, so they have to really work hard. It's got to be better than than board game kind of rules, right, or whatever for skirmish. They're gonna have to work hard too. And I think, they have the basis of, you know, they can, if it has the flavor of the RPG combat and things, they have some place to start, and they have things to call, they have names to call things, you know, based on the RPG. So we'll see. We'll see how they handle it. And I'm curious to see the rules. And I'm not in love with the miniatures, but yeah, it's fun. We'll see. Yeah. They have it's playful. It's a more playful look. It's not so...
Because that's what you want from your greedy neon-drenched chrome-splashed dystopia, is playful.
It's playful. Yeah. It's cute. Yeah. Right. So this has been one hell of a year. And we have a list now. This is a courtesy of DriveThruRPG, the list of the best-selling non-D&D.
Well, I was going to say, let's just jump right to number two. Best-selling RPG, starting at number two. Yeah.
Right. And these are just RPG publications. So there's sometimes our source books or support things. And funny enough, the number one is Ancestry and Culture, An Alternative to Race in 5e.
Okay. Yep.
So it is it's a 5e book, but it's trying to expand and kind of, make 5e do things that it wasn't originally doing. And I think that's, so that has got to make Wizards kind of pay attention a little bit, if that's the best-selling book this year.
Does it? Because if it's on DriveThruRPG, because if it's on the DMs Guild, it's kind of Wizards already.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So that's Arcanist Press released that. Number two is Iron Sworn Delve.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the Sean Tompkin Iron Sworn Delve, number two. So that's number two best-selling this year. That's great. That's a...
I can't remember if Delve was of the free PDF, because Iron Sworn was definitely a free PDF.
Yeah, I don't think so. That's what I was going to ask you, is giving away the core rules for as a PDF for free, do you think that helped the sales of Delve?
Well, obviously, I have no inside knowledge into the creator's finances. But I can say, personally, based on how impressed I was with Iron Sworn, which I got for free, that's what got me to buy the other two hardback copies of Iron Sworn and Delve. I just went, yep, I like this enough. This is awesome. And it's free. Let's buy the books.
I think that's a good way to do it. I mean, that may be worth it in the future, because people are very curious about core rules. And it really is disappointing to invest $40, $50 into a book and be like, this rule set is not...
Which is why I haven't picked up Cyberpunk Red. I'm interested, not $50 interested.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's an unreasonable price for a game. I'm just saying, not for me.
Right. So number three was Legend of the Five Rings, Path of Waves. So that was, now it's Edge Studio, but remember it's previously Fantasy Flight. They moved them over. All their RPGs. Number four is Flying Circus, The Core Rulebook by Newsstand Press. The Halls of Ardenvul, Complete. the Expeditious Retreat Press is the title. Witcher's Journal, The Artelsarian by Artelsarian Games. Dishonored, I was surprised to see this. The Dishonored horror book by Modiphius. Yeah, so that's kind of an assassin, steampunky kind of assassin.
Yeah, I think I wonder if they use their 2d20 thing. Yes, I think I was going to make a snarky quip about, oh, it's d20. Then I went, oh, it's the 2d20.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, it is. Yeah, so I didn't like the comics in that book. I had a review copy of the PDF, and they do a whole lot of kind of setting the scene and giving the lore and stuff in not very well done comics, because the art for that game is pretty nice. It's pretty impressive.
And it kind of doesn't match?
Yeah, it's just a little rough and a little amateur, so I think they hurt themselves production-wise with that. Wolves of God, Adventures in the Dark Ages of England, Synonymine, published. Night Horrors, Nameless and Accursed by Onyx Path. And number 10 was Lunar's Fangs at Night, another Onyx Path. So two Onyx Path publications in that year. Yeah, so it's interesting. There wasn't anything, I mean, I knew Ironsworn, but there wasn't anything else that like stood out. And the Dishonored was very surprising, because that's, you know, based on a game IP. Yeah,
I wonder if that's part of it.
Maybe, yeah, that's true. But yeah, I don't know. So maybe the system works. I got to give the system maybe another look, because maybe it works well.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But also, and this is not meant to throw any of those creators under the bus, best-selling does not mean good, you know?
That's
I mean,
true.
How many games? Yeah. Actually, not that many. But you know, we've all bought games and we go, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's curious. Yeah, so that's an interesting. There was no Cthulhu. I'm surprised, like, the things that weren't there. I mean, there is the World of Darkness, right?
Yeah.
But there were just things that like are kind of omnipresent in RPG lists that I didn't see. So yeah, interesting enough. But it was a messed up year anyhow. Maybe people just squatted down with things they already bought and were just like, I'm not spending any money that's not gonna go to food. All right. Well, since we had already talked a little bit about Cyberpunk Red, let's, and this was inspired by a jam that's going on now on itch.io. But let's talk a little bit about the baggage of cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. And maybe specifically, because that's a pretty huge topic, so maybe specifically kind of inspired by the game jam, the Asian portrayal, kind of like how Asia is portrayed. And so it's a little difficult, and you know how annoyed I am by analysis, by podcast analysis of Oriental adventures and things like that. I thought it was a little interesting. So I would say cyberpunk is kind of sci-fi's grim dark. Okay. You know, it's nobody's good. Everything's kind of turned up to, I mean, you can say the Netrunners they're kind of anti-heroes, but they're not good people, because they're doing it for money, or they're doing it for revenge or whatever. So nobody particularly has, you know, lofty ideals or would be considered
good.
Yeah. Good aligned. And the thing that comes up, so I looked at a couple of writings about the problem with cyberpunk as far as portraying Asians, and they talk about the yellow perilist tropes. And I don't know. I mean, it seems like, okay, so cyberpunk is not, I don't think it's people reacting, it's not like, because it's an American, you know, basically an American genre. And originally, the writing, the books themselves are a reaction to old 50s, 60s sci-fi, to Asimov and Heinlein. It's a reaction to that. And it's like, let's make this ours. Let's make it, you know, rough and ugly and, you know, something that I feel more connected to, not so, you know, high-minded and ethereal and traveling. You know, it's on the planet. The planet sucks, and we're fighting it out against the corporations. So it already has this adolescent, a little bit of immaturity to it, because it's like, this ain't your grandpa's sci-fi kind of style. So when they talk about the yellow perilous tropes, I don't think that's completely accurate. I don't think that really works, because what I think cyberpunk is, and I'm talking more about maybe Mike Pondsmith's world, because the books are a little bit more diverse. The books have a lot of different approaches and a lot of different angles, and the only thing that kind of ties through is the cyber of the world. You know, they have the Netrunners versus the, you know, some corporate or government interest. But I really think that it's that exposure that anime and a lot of movies gave us to seeing what Asia looks like, the population density, the kind of way people live, you know, in bigger Asian cities. So I mean like Hong Kong, Tokyo, those are the inspirations. And taking that and transplanting that, what if that's what Los Angeles looked like? What if that's what California looked like? That would be very, that's a, you know, that's a, just kind of a speculative fiction dystopia. And I think that's really where it comes from. It's not reacting to this Asian threat of Japan bought the Empire State Building. What are we going to do? Well,
in that case, I got to be the opposite side of the argument
here. Right, right.
So I've seen a couple really good threads and retweeted a really couple really good threads mm-hmm. about this. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking the opposite side of the coin, where I do think a lot of cyberpunk, at least initially, came from that like boom in the 80s mm-hmm. and the fear that Japan, and which represented Asia, would eventually just kind of become this economic powerhouse mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that the States would become, you know, second or right, possibly right. even third. Mm-hmm. But even what you said about if you look at the style of those cities, especially like Tokyo and Hong Kong, if you transplant that to California or the States,
right.
and that becomes your dystopia, mm-hmm. isn't that a comment on those Asian cities?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, we've never seen that before. That's not how the West lives. We don't live on top of each other, you know, subsisting on, you know, bowls of noodles and things. I mean, there are things of the lifestyle of Southeast Asia and, well, maybe you do, but of Southeast Asia and that are definitely shocking to an American sensibility, that, you know, just kind of sprawling suburbs and, you know, that. And so that does make it very, and always the American version of cyberpunk is mixed culture. It's right. extremely mixed culture. So it's not just this Asian invasion or you know, the kind of, you know, Asia has conquered and we're kind of surviving. It's a mix. And I think the main reason why Japan works well and why it's never quite been replaced by China is because of Japan's soft empire. You know, okay. there's so those tropes come from Japanese soft empire, you know, like using samurai, geisha, those things. That's because that was exported so heavily mm-hmm. in Japanese media. So it's not like this, you know, racist view of Asia, because that's what we were sold. In
well,
the 80s.
I agree with you, and I agree that like that's kind of what got sold. Mm-hmm. But the use of the word dystopia, mm-hmm. if the exportation of that to the States and then the integration of that into American kind of daily life, if that is seen as a negative, and if that becomes the dystopia, that is a comment on those cities, right?
Like. Yeah, yeah.
And it might be more that I'm thinking of Blade Runner specifically, mm-hmm. kind of like the iconic, you know, or Gibson's Neo Mansion, all that kind of stuff, right? That's kind of the iconic cyberpunk things.
Right, right.
Those stories are kind of dark by themselves, right? Mm. Like we discussed, like anti-hero and kind of like maybe a middle finger to like the 1950s, like mm-hmm. Asimov and the Heinlein kind of stuff. So those stories were possibly already dark and gritty to begin with, already mm-hmm. kind of dystopian. So it isn't only the importation of Asian culture. Mm-hmm. But then if you also import that Asian culture and say, wow, look how bad and shitty this thing is, that it got imported and that we now have to live like this, that is a comment on those cities.
It's just lost in translation is all. It's a mistranslation.
Ooh, I think we're going to disagree on that.
No, I think it really is, because I don't think there's a deliberate way. Oh, I can't believe how people live. It's seeing those cities, seeing Hong Kong and Tokyo, I'm just using specifically as examples, but seeing the, you know, the hyper
like population density.
Yeah, yeah. Hyper capitalized, hyper mm-hmm. like people having to work. And America not really, and that's something we can talk about with what Asian voices can bring to cyberpunk, but we hadn't really seen like the effects of kind of technology-based jobs and mm-hmm. and how people are kind of minimalizing their lives just to function in these societies, and seeing that, I mean, as a future and not a happy future, because we're moving away from kind of how you know, how we had set things up with you know, happy car factory jobs or going to the you know, going to the office from the suburbs. So that was a very, I don't think it's just something that looking at it from the outside. So nobody that wrote using that was ever in that culture, ever understood any of that. It's the veneer of that. And that's mm-hmm. the big thing about cyberpunk, is it's all surface.
Oh yeah.
No depth, all surface. So they're trying to look for something that is foreign. It's definitely shockingly foreign. And I think the reason that Japan works so well is because of katakana.
Yeah.
The katakana graphically, visually works very well. Kanji Chinese characters don't. It's a little too complicated, and there's a little too much a little too much room for mistranslation and too much error. So I think that's why that, you know, why the anime aesthetic worked very well in Cyberpunk, because visually that just works very well. Like, so Cyrillic and Japanese katakana looks so alien and foreign, and you know make it look like this. It's just a crazy mashup of cultures with everything that represents those cultures just turned up to 150, you know, percent.
So, as we're rolling into the Christmas series, like, I guess living here, and this is kind of a tangent, yeah, I can definitely see how Japan has adopted a lot of stuff, kind of old cultural stuff, without necessarily the context, and kind of made it their own, which on the one hand is pretty amazing, and on the other hand is kind of weird when you see Colonel Sanders dressed up in Santa and everything is decorated in Christmas
stuff.
Without the religious basing that was there. But I think we can possibly move on. I still think I disagree with you just by the fact of who these authors were, that they've taken this other culture and presented it as alien. Like, whether or not that's what the Asian countries were exporting. But I remember this thread on Blade Runner, and the idea that the reason there was that geisha on that huge screen, and the reason we see Decker in a street side noodle shop using chopsticks, and the reason we see all these Asian inspired things is, at the time, this was presented as a negative. It was intended to be shocking that this average American Joe was forced to use chopsticks.
Right.
That the presentation of beauty was not the white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed kind of, you know, American woman on the big screen. It was a Japanese woman, right?
Right.
Kind of the forcible exportation of culture was part of the dystopia of Blade Runner.
Yeah, but also the kind of modern Asian cities representing an economy and a sacrifice of quality of life that it was coming. And that's not racial. That's not, I mean, that's purely a product of capitalism.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Like, and I totally see that as the sort of logical extension of capitalism. I disagree with it. Maybe it was unconscious. I disagree with it being racially biased, because then it could have been pretty much any other culture. Or why was it not Americanized, right? Why was it these Asian countries that we cherry picked from show a dystopia? Whether it was intentionally racially motivated or not, I don't think you can escape from the fact that it then becomes racist because you picked another culture to represent this alien kind of capitalistic force.
But if you do that, you know, Judge Dredd handled that, you know,
that's a good example.
Yeah, hyper-American future. Yeah. That doesn't use any foreign or exotic.
Like Judge Dredd was actually a UK comic,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
So, I mean, I guess, okay, you want to get technical. You could maybe argue that it is a bit racist then, because here's this culture that's not really your own. But I mean, like UK and US are pretty much so racially close, I don't really think it counts. But I mean, you could make the argument. But I think Judge Dredd is in a good example of here is this ridiculous, hyper-capitalistic, hyper-violent future that we did not pull from an alien, exotic culture to then make a dystopia.
I see. Yeah, but I still think, I mean, it's naive. I'm not arguing that it's not childish and naive. I think that whole setting, that whole genre, it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't, and I certainly agree with you, and I've read a couple articles that because cyberpunk is basically all style and no substance, it's easily co-opted by capitalism and corporate entities itself, which is kind of the point we're at.
Right. But also, too, I mean, we live in Asia. This is a reality. Asian pop culture, Asian status is very surface. And that matches cyberpunk very well. So, of course, like, if it's going to be a genre that is all surface, an Asian aesthetic matches very well. Chrome and neon is exactly what the 80s looked like in Tokyo.
It absolutely does. And I think what's happened is, since that starting point of cyberpunk, since this is a kind of a gaming podcast, just like a lot of the sacred cows in D&D that get ported to edition, because they've always been there, the Asian aesthetic, the yes. neon katakana yes. characters, kind right. of like the geisha, the street samurai, that has all been ported to every iteration of cyberpunk simply because that's what the original was.
Right, right.
And there hasn't really been, at least that I'm aware of. I'm sure it exists, right? Mm-hmm. But I think in mainstream media, there's not been a critical attention to why these things have been included. It's just, that's cyberpunk, so that's what we're including.
Right.
Rather than, you know what, maybe we should update this or at least kind of decide why we're including
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, because especially, and that becomes difficult with the nostalgia factor.
Yeah,
like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, once that, you know, things are wrapped up in nostalgia, like, well, it's not cyberpunk if it doesn't have,
yeah.
yeah. But we may get some answers. Yeah. If we take a look at this, the game jam that's going on, it's called The Cyberpunk by Asian Creators Group, Asian Creators Game Jam. So it's running until the end of January. And it's a call for Asian creators to contribute cyberpunk settings. And there's a few interesting responses by some of the creators. They're collecting work that not only sidesteps the pitfalls of dressing a game in loose stereotypes, but celebrates the reality of lived experience. So the jam hopes to expand what players consider possible within cyberpunk RPGs. And I like this quote a lot, and I'll tell you who said this, but Asian cultures are often fetishized in nerd culture, and you can find a lot of Asian themed games without any Asian creators on DriveThruRPG. So WH author, the tabletop designer, and the host, one of the hosts of this jam, said earlier this year, I hosted the Asian Martial Arts Jam, and a jam for Asian creators to create martial arts TTRPGs with their own voice. And so an effort to get voices that kind of bring some reality or to take away some of the tropes of that. And oh, sorry, here it is. So Western writers, oh yeah, this is talking about the takeover. That's not the thing that I want. Okay, here we go. I think Western cyberpunk owes a lot to Asian cyberpunk. And what Western cyberpunk fails to realize is that Asian iterations of the genre tend to be really fucking horrific. So where the white man sees power and progress in the integration of man and machine, the Asian man, essentially, you know, post-World War II, sees horror, perversion, a deviance from the natural state of things. And I think that's a very powerful aesthetic that's not seen. And I think that the perspective, because we don't really think about like what your perspective and what your relation to technology would be being from Asia or being from Asian culture. And a couple of the things that kind of came to mind was, you know, tech manufacturing occurs here. And so especially in poorer countries in Southeast Asia, that's the savior of your
economy.
Yeah, yeah, right. So those kind of jobs, even though they're not good jobs, they may be very dirty jobs as far as like the environment, and they may be very hard because they're setting up nets outside the buildings to stop, you know, roof jumpers. It may be very hard, you know, psychically on you. It still is a savior. It still is a, it still economically gave you an opportunity to earn a living and raise a family. And so, you know, opportunity, but also kind of an enslavement, an enslavement by a global economy that, you know, you're fitting in very low at the bottom because people want their iPhones. Mm. And then things like, you know, the atomic bomb. Is the height of technology that is inescapable in Japanese psyche. And that is why, you know, you don't worship the kind of the ultimate extent of technology because that's where it leads.
Right.
That's exactly where it leads. And also the kind of the trashy kind of single-use disposability of things becomes much more apparent in, and it's not part of original kind of Asian culture. It's kind of forced upon it, especially coming from a post-war where things were where you worried about food and shelter and everything post-war. Now it's this single-use disposed kind of fast fashion culture is imposed upon that. So those are things and those are influences that the West doesn't really have a very good hold on, but actually are part of the, you know, what would inform an Asian cyberpunk.
I've seen a couple posts, I guess I've seen one, that in light of the whole like Cyberpunk 2077 and CD Projekt Red and all that stuff, talking about or saying that cyberpunk as a genre is dead.
Mm.
And I kind of disagree. And I've seen a couple other people disagree, specifically related to this. We're like, okay, maybe Western cyberpunk is dead. We've had enough of the grizzled anti-hero protagonist just out to make a buck.
Mm-hmm.
What we haven't seen is like the non-white specifically Asian mm-hmm. voices doing the take on cyberpunk.
Right.
And cyberpunk as a genre is not dead because genres don't die.
Mm.
You just, okay, you haven't, or we haven't had the opportunity to experience cyberpunk as presented by other voices.
Right.
And what that leads to.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think definitely I was reading a lot. Last year I was reading a lot of English translated Chinese science fiction.
Oh, interesting.
And the diversity of that, because it doesn't have the influence of kind of the canon of standard Western science fiction writers, the diversity of that and the interesting way that they were reflecting, because, you know, science fiction reflects the now and kind of immediate very strongly.
It's the good science fiction is an extension of a current problem.
Right, right. And so there was a lot of really interesting exploration about identity and kind of the having two minds and two faces constantly, the kind of dysphoria of that. And so I know that there's a lot of good cyberpunk inspired, at least like transhuman and future stories out there that are just not being translated.
Right.
You know, we have access to a lot of that. We should have access to a lot of that. And it's going to take writers like Ken Liu, who is the translator of the collections that I was reading. So he's a writer himself, but he also translates a lot of the short science fiction from China. And we need those people to kind of bring those new voices in, so people have new inspiration and new influences.
I certainly don't want to discount human translators, because
yes.
Working at a Japanese company, having to use Google Translate, that thing's
right,
a mess, right?
Uh-huh.
But this might be a situation where technology actually is helpful, because technology makes transmission of information easier, mm-hmm. possibly would be able to translate stuff, you know?
Yeah, I don't know, but yeah, English is especially tricky, I think, with Asian languages. It's like,
Yeah.
Machine translation of Japanese and English is brutal.
You might end up with garbage. And like I said, translators do a hell of a job.
Mm-hmm.
And since we live in a country that can't seem to get English phrases right and just feeds official stuff through Google Translate, and that's why you end up with all kinds of wacky things on official government signage.
Right.
It drives me crazy, where it's like, just pay someone to translate into their native language. So I certainly do not want to discount native language translators
and that
human element actually doing it.
Right.
Then.
So I think the difficult thing, and I'm wondering, because they're talking about specifically, like, you know, a Malaysian designer or an Asian, like someone living in Asia, presenting a new perspective or a new takes on cyberpunk. But I think as far as, and what we've been dealing with before is Asian Americans, Asian Canadians, Asian Australians, they're still in the
diaspora.
They're in the culture of the West.
Okay.
And I don't think they grew up American or Australian or Canadian, and they have some influence from their parents, maybe have some language, have, you know, some values that they were taught, but in, you know, out of context. And so that's a difficult situation, because it must be frustrating to see those stereotypes, those tropes, the fetishization of Asian, but not, you know, they're American or they're Canadian. It's like, why am I, you know, kind of tolerating this but they can't bring anything different to it. You know,
I think as someone who's kind of in the same situation, and I don't want to speak for anyone, but I guess I can't speak to anyone except for myself. You're kind of in a liminal space where you're not really considered part of either group.
Right. Yeah.
And so while you may identify with elements from both or multiple groups, you're never really fully considered part of one.
Right.
And that brings its own issues, and you have your own unique voice to speak from that place.
Right.
I guess in terms of, since we're talking about cyberpunk.
Yeah.
And what that would mean for cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but just, I think that has to be a little frustrating, because you're in the culture that created that genre, and fixing it, I think requires other eyes and outside. Yeah, and outside.
Also, probably not your responsibility. Not your responsibility to fix anything you don't want to fix, right?
Right. Yeah. So interesting. So take a look at itch.io. I'll put a link to that to that jam, and you can see what people are doing, and just kind of different approaches. Because I do think, especially with the release of the game, that cyberpunk is, the baggage of it does come from Reagan 80s and white guys, reactionary science fiction, and all of the tropes and kind of things that they saw you know, just kind of stereotypes that they're like, what if, what if, what if?
And their what if ends up being really boring.
Yeah, 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 right, right. And just kind of stacked up a bunch of nonsense. And yeah, so it's going to constantly be, it's going to constantly be that. So
I'm letting my viewings of Blade Runner 2049 and Ready Player One color my opinion, where it's just like, you have, especially in terms of like transhumanism, like you have all these different roles for body presentation, and it's still boring as
right
because it's coming from the same perspective. Oh man, that's so frustrating in Ready Player One, which is a shit movie, book, where it's like, oh, look at all these different bodies you have, and you can't get over the fact that one of your friends ends up being a different gender than you thought they were when you went to battle with a fucking cat boy right. and the Iron Giant next to you. Why is this an issue? My God. Anyway, so sorry.
I guess I have to return your Christmas present.
Yes,
then.
You do. Yes, if it's Ready Player 2, yes, if it's Ready Player 2, which is apparently even fucking worse than Ready Player 1, if that was possible, and it's still going to get a movie deal.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah, because it's the, and I think that's a little bit of the problem, with Cyberpunk too, is just kind of genre mashup, you know, and so just like slamming a bunch of things together and
not looking at it critically.
Yeah, and just for the sake of, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you had a samurai sword and a machine gun and you're, you know, a flying car and like, okay.
Yeah. That's why I'm, that's my reaction too. But which, I mean, possibly gets back to that core problem we mentioned where Cyberpunk is all style and no substance.
Right, right. So. Yeah. So we'll see. Yes. And maybe there is some enlightenment. Enlightenment to be found on itch.io. No, but on itch.io. Oh, yeah. So some new perspectives. So great. Oh, one quick thing I wanted to mention. Yeah. Sorry. We had a great comment. So our discussion of alignment, we got a comment from Joshua Carnes, who gave us a really nice historical context. Every comment that starts actually, I'm always like, I'm not even reading this, but it was an excellent, he just basically like went through historical context and why, you know, alignment is in the situation it's in. So I encourage everybody to take a look at that on last week's
I will actually
cast.
Go check it out.
Yeah,
now,
it's really good.
Even though if it starts with actually.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Listen, there are no actualities present.
All right.
So a really good job. And, you know, talking about basically what you talked about, the beginning was just a binary between, you know, law and order,
right.
or you know, law and chaos, you know, basically was the binary.
Law and order is the show.
that started things out. But I forgot, like, the satanic panic and things, that had influence on, okay, we got to take evil, the ability to play evil characters. Oh, the 90s is here. Oh, evil's back. You know, so a really good breakdown of kind of the history of alignments, specifically in D&D. So take a look at that, and I'll link back to that if that helps get to the comment. But so thank you, Joshua, for that. That really was a nice, and I like when a discussion and actually constructive, you know, input helps make a
don't podcast. Start your comment with actually.
Yeah,
so
right.
We actually read it.
Right, actually, I should just have that as a filter word, but. But anyhow, so where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always. That's HiveMind, HYVEMYND, where mixed in with my exhaustive parenting tweets are a belonging outside belonging game hack of the 90s sci-fi series Lex.
Oh, nice.
Which I'm going to type up and we're going to play.
Oh, nice. Excellent. All right. So if you'd like to find more of The Weekly, please visit utterredhands.com. And we have the YouTube channel and Twitch as well. YouTube is where you can find the video. So anything we're like visually referring to while we're talking and you're hearing this only on the podcast, take a look at the YouTube channel so you can see like what actually we're referring to. Oh, and speaking of, what is on the table?
My copy of Wrath and Glory showed up the other day. And
so now you have both ends of the modern Games Workshop universe.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, as much time as I spent thinking about them, I figured, I should get the official games.
Nice. Yeah. So, yeah, hopefully we can talk and flip through this and hopefully play eventually. Mm. But so a new, and this, so this was.
This was came purchased. Out August 2020, I think.
But this is an adaptation. Like they got the rights.
I think this is an adaptation of the Ulysses Spiel,
Wrath
and Glory.
Yeah.
I have no idea what is different. I am under the impression that some things are different.
Oh, okay. Well, we will find out. Cool. So that is it for this week. Please come back next week because we will be here.
Oh, yeah. Later, mortals.
Bye.